Strange Studies of Strange Stories.
Carson opened his eyes and found himself looking upwards into a flickering blue dimness. It was hot, and he was lying on sand, and a rock embedded in the sand was hurting his back. He rolled over to his side, off the rock, and then pushed himself up to a sitting position. "I'm crazy," he thought. "Crazy, or dead, or something." The sand was blue, bright blue, and there wasn't any such thing as bright blue sand on Earth, or any of the planets. Blue sand under a blue dome that wasn't the sky, nor yet a room, but a circumscribed area. Somehow he knew it was circumscribed and finite, even though he couldn't see to the top of it.
That is the opening of Frederick Brown's Arena, a story about blue sand. And that's my takeaway from the whole thing. It's just about blue sand.
Well, what does the blue sand represent, though, Chris? That's what we're going to be grading you on today.
Oh, geez.
We'll check around at the end of the episode, see how you do. Okay. We're in the second month of Strange Studies of Strange Stories, and it's time for you to be tested and evaluated. First, please state your name so I can make sure you're in the right place.
I am Chris Lackey.
All right, Chris Lackey, here you are. Crossing you off the list, I'm Chad Pfeiffer. Hello. We're here exclusively on Patreon, but you can learn all about us at strangestudies.com and even hppodcraft.com. It's all in the same witch house. Uh-huh. You will need to get your hand stamped if you want to leave. Otherwise, no re-entry. That's something you should know, because this isn't just a test-taking space. It's also a club called Blue Sand.
Wow. I feel so alive.
Who was that reader?
That reader is our beloved Rafe Ball.
Yes.
If you like Rafe's voice, and I know you do because I just love it.
Yeah.
He does LibriVox readings, and you can find him over there. Just look for Rafe Ball, and he's done a bunch of readings, full story readings of some great stuff. He will be releasing very soon Jerry Jarvis's Wig.
Oh, no kidding.
Yeah. Full reading.
Yeah, he read for that episode and then also gave us some crucial information that led to that Wig song.
Yes.
Which I hear in my head here and there. Rafe is always welcome at Blue Sand. He gets waved right to the front of the line. A lady on each arm and a chap on each leg. That's his motto. Rafe Ball. So, Arena by Frederick Brown. As with last week's story, this story was selected by the members of the Science Fiction Writers of America as one of the best science fiction stories published before the advent of the Nebula Awards. They couldn't give these stories an award, so they put them all together in the Science Fiction Hall of Fame, Volume 1, 1929 to 1964. I picked it out for that reason, but also because I just wanted some action.
Yeah.
Something named Arena, there's probably going to be some action in it, I thought. And after reading it, I thought, right.
You did.
What do we know about this author, Frederick Brown?
Frederick Brown was born in 1906 in Cincinnati, Ohio. That's all I got for his early life. Not much information about him out there. But he was first published in 1936. But his first sci-fi story wasn't until 1941 with Not Yet the End in a magazine called Captain Future.
Wow. So we know about his birth and then nothing else until his 30s. Very Christ-like, Frederick Brown. How have I never heard of a magazine called Captain Future?
I was thinking the same thing.
Oh my gosh. You know what? That's going to be the name of the VIP club within Blue Sand.
Ooh.
Double hand stamp.
Frederick seemed to come out swinging with his first novel, What Mad Universe, which was a parody of sci-fi conventions. It also says here that his wife, she said this about him, Frederick Brown hated to write, so he did everything he could to avoid it. He played his flute, challenged a friend to a game of chess, or teased Ming Ta, the Siamese cat. If Brown had trouble working out a certain story, he would hop on a long bus trip and just sit and think and plot for days on end.
Sure, Frederick Brown's wife. That's what he was doing on those bus trips.
He wrote a lot of stuff in a lot of different genres. He wrote mystery, Western, sci-fi, but he was known for his short-form stories that were only a page to 3 pages long.
That's also known as flash fiction. Fans of that format are known as flashers. I'm a huge flasher. I tell everybody, you know, just this week I moved into a new neighborhood, and what I plan to do on the weekend is go around to the neighbors, introduce myself, and let them know I'm a flasher. You're a flasher? Guilty as charged, man. That's what I'm going to say in those interactions.
Philip K. Dick described Frederick's 1945 short story, The Waveries, as what may be the most significant, startlingly so, story sci-fi has yet produced. I have a question. Why aren't we covering that story?
I don't know. Why is the sand blue? We're just in a crazy world. That's all I can say.
Brown is also known as one of the three dedicatees and Robert A. Heinlein's Stranger in a Strange Land. Mm. And Stephen King's Danse Macabre mentions Brown's collection Nightmares and Giesenstacks as being particularly important.
Giesenstacks? That sounds like something from Jabberwock.
Yeah.
A thematic connection, I guess. Mm-hmm. Last week's story.
Brown, unfortunately, passed away in 1972 at the age of 65.
Which gets him inducted into our list of authors. And for those who have asked, yes, on Strange Studies of Strange Stories, we are still pretty much exclusively covering deceased authors.
This story, Arena, was first published in June 1944, astounding science fiction, and might be most well known because it was the inspiration for the Star Trek, the original series episode of the same name.
Ah, it is. Okay, we were wondering that last week, so they are connected.
So let me take you back to October 10th, 1966. A bunch of writers had not turned in their scripts, and the TOS staff are in a bit of a scramble. So producer Gene L. Kuhn decided he was going to pop a script out in a hurry. He left on Friday, came back Monday with the first draft. Gene was a huge sci-fi nut, and he read lots of sci-fi. And it wasn't until Joan Pierce, a script reviewer, read Gene's script and said, you know, this reminds me a lot of Brown's story. And he went back and looked at it, and he's like, oh, geez, you know. Probably remembered reading the story at one point in his life. And then made it into a script. So what they decided to do, because they liked the script so much, is that they reached out to Brown and offered to buy the rights. They did not tell him that they already wrote a script on it. So he accepted, and the rest is history.
So that's the Star Trek episode Arena. But, you know, the way you put that, so he did it accidentally just because he reads so much.
Yeah.
It sounds more like he was trying to get away with something and Joan caught him. And then the producers said, we got to give this guy some dough because you basically cribbed this story. But I don't even remember that episode. Who fights whom in
it's
that?
It's the Gorn episode, the lizard man with Kirk.
Oh, of course I remember that episode then. Okay. Yeah, okay. Yeah. Well, after reading this, I didn't see any relation between the two.
There is. The whole idea is there's another alien that takes a Gorn and a human and makes them fight. And whoever wins their ship is going to be saved, and the other one's destroyed.
Right. The format's the same, but the nature of the alien is so.
Yes.
And also, they didn't, in this story, the fighting isn't limp like it is in the Gorn. I mean, that is one of the best Star Trek episodes ever, just for the, I mean, it doesn't even have the energy of children play fighting.
Yeah.
It's got the weakest choreography I've ever seen. It's great. It's a great episode.
Well, in defense of that episode, the reason why they were doing it that way is because Kirk was fast, but not strong enough to hurt the Gorn, and the Gorn was super strong and super tough, but not fast enough to actually get his hands on Kirk, so they were kind of stalemated.
Oh, that's sort of like this story, too, I guess. Yeah.
But
that's the one where he makes, like, the diamond gun, right?
He finds the elements of gunpowder and makes a cannon that shoots diamonds at the thing and wins the fight, which it's very different than this story. And actually, I think the Star Trek episode's a bit of an improvement on this, but let's talk about it before we get into it.
I don't know if I agree with that. Okay. I mean, it's iconic. I do love that story. I remember enjoying it in a not ironic way when I was young.
Oh, yeah.
I didn't find it funny. I just thought it was cool.
It is cool. There is some, you know, like you said, the fight scenes are kind of dumb, but there's a lot of really neat stuff in there.
Well, they worked for me as a youngster.
Yeah. Now, The Outer Limits also had a similar episode to this story. It was called Fun and Games, and this story was adapted by Marvel Comics in the anthology series Worlds Unknown in 1973.
All right. Well, enough with these adaptations. Let's open the trench coat, as we say in the Flasher community, and just get into it, see what's going on.
It begins with our protagonist, Bob Carson, waking up naked.
Go on.
On an alien world covered in blue sand. We know that this is an alien world because it has blue sand, and according to Bob, no other alien worlds have ever been found with blue sand. So this is a unique alien place.
And that also gives us information. We know that he knows about alien worlds, that this is some kind of future Earth civilization. It says he was sitting in hot blue sand, stark naked, but otherwise unhurt. That implies that it hurts him to be naked. Gah, I'm naked. Come on, Bob Carson. You should feel free.
Well, when you're naked and you got to sit on some rocks or some sand, that's not very comfortable.
You're right. You should put a trench coat down on that stuff. Keep it safe.
The last thing Bob remembers is that he was part of a space armada for Earth in a one-man fighter near Pluto.
Some kind of scouting ship. The Earth forces are all arrayed, ready for battle elsewhere, and he was off on his own when his alarm systems let him know that another small craft was out there and it was coming for him. And this is one of what they call the Outsiders. And they call these enemies the Outsiders, not because they're fans of the S.E. Hinton young adult novel, as I am, My first assumption was maybe this is Pony Boy in the ship coming after him.
I thought
him.
The same thing.
But yeah. No, they call them the Outsiders because they don't know anything about these creatures. Also, maybe they're Lovecraft fans. Who knows?
Oh, yeah, could be. The humans have never actually seen any of them in person, and they're not actually sure what the Outsiders are or where they come from. They've had lots of space battles, but none of that has resulted in them actually capturing the enemy.
When they've engaged, the Outsiders have either killed the Earth people or disappeared or been totally eradicated, like you say. Mm-hmm. So they have no idea what they are, but they've been... It started slow. They were menacing the Earth Empire here and there, raiding outposts, raiding colonies. But the menace has been building. I did like the writing is very ham-fisted, pulpy, and at points kind of made me laugh with its mm-hmm. repetition. Yeah. Sometimes the language is a little clunky, but... It is nice that it gives you lots of information without stating it explicitly.
Yeah.
The fact that it mentions colonies and outposts and these kinds of things lets you know where we are in the development without explicating it. It's good in that respect.
The Earth forces have detected a huge fleet incoming, so they're going to have a big battle, a battle that could decide the fate of the human race.
It says, scouts 20 billion miles out had detected the approach of a mighty fleet of Outsiders. Those scouts had never come back, but their radiotronic messages had... And now Earth's armada, all 10,000 ships and 500,000 fighting spacemen, were out there, outside Pluto's orbit, waiting to intercept and battle to the death. Anybody's battle, with the mastery of the solar system hanging in the balance, on an even chance. A last and only chance. For Earth and all her colonies lay at the utter mercy of the Outsiders if they ran that gauntlet.
So Bob engaged in a space battle with this other ship when suddenly a planet appeared out of nowhere. There shouldn't have been a planet there. There was a planet. His ship was about to crash when Bob blacked out. Now he's here, naked. Did I mention he was naked?
It certainly gets mentioned a lot in the story. So far, it's coming up on the show a lot, too. These naked characters, usually dancing.
Yeah.
In this case, it's a dance of death.
Besides blue sand, the planet seems to have about Earth's gravity. There are smatterings of blue bushes here and there in varying shades of blue, but still blue. And then he sees this little lizard-like creature scurry around, except it has 10 legs instead of 4. And it is, of course, blue. Above him is this dome, this huge dome kind of thing. It looks like a sky, but it's not a sky. He guesses it's about 250 yards in circumference. It comes down all around him, and he's within this generally open space, not unlike an arena.
Ah, so that's where the title comes from. You know, this could have been, there was that little blue world that the crazy mad scientist in Mad God was messing around with. This could easily be within the world of Mad God.
Ooh.
Another connection to our bonus episode last month.
Everything is blue except for this red shape in the distance. It says it's roughly spherical. It seemed to be about a yard in diameter. Bob then hears a voice telepathically, and it says,
through spaces and dimensions wandering and in this space and time, I find two peoples about to exterminate one and so weaken the other that it would retrogress and never fulfill its destiny, but decay and return to mindless dust whence it came. This is such a Star Trek thing.
Yeah.
The intervening godlike uh-huh. alien.
Yeah, yeah.
And also, what a weird thing. I'm going around looking for battles that are just about even, and then I create this arena scenario. It seems like a weird thing to be interested in.
Well, it says it can't explain who or what it is, other than it is the end of evolution of a race. So old, it can't be explained that it is fused into a single entity eternal.
Oh, it's kind of Borg-like.
I guess. They don't really explain what it is. They can't explain. It cannot be explained.
Yeah.
However, it does explain that both the Outsiders and the Earthers might be like this eternal one day, but not if they fight this war. And he says that he could send the Outsiders back from where they came from, but they would just eventually return. So one race must be destroyed so that the other can thrive.
It would be really funny if some junior high kid had to read the Outsiders and they got this mistakenly. Can you imagine the feeling of dread as you showed up to class? What are they talking about? Because I wrote down a lot of notes about what this blue sand might mean. The intelligence says, from the outskirts of the not yet battle, I plucked two individuals, you and an Outsider. I see from your mind that in your early history of nationalisms, battles between champions to decide issues between races were not unknown.
So they've been put on equal standing in an environment that is equally uncomfortable to both of them. Also, physical strength will not decide this contest, but ingenuity. There is a barrier that separates them, and they must figure out a way to kill the other. The Eternal explains that this place is outside space and time, and the battle that they were in has been put on hold until this contest is decided.
If you die here, not only do you die in the real world, but your entire race will die. And that's it. The voice is gone. That idea of champions fighting out a war is a pretty seductive one.
Yeah.
You know, the fact that so many soldiers and have to die and so much damage to landscapes and property and art and value. Mm-hmm. Can the leaders who decide these things just go duke it out? You always think that, but then you go, well, wait, do I want my president to be the one to go out and do that? And then if I pick a champion, you know, the minute your champion got killed, you'd go, no, wait a minute. That wasn't fair. I'm going to have another champion. Yeah. And then pretty soon you're back at war. Yeah. So I guess it falls apart.
Well, if the groups are honorable, you can save thousands or tens of thousands of lives. And if they stuck to those results, obviously it's better, but...
Oh, it's way better. It would definitely, these folks that actually, the rich men who start the wars, would probably think again if they were the ones that had to crawl around in the blue sand naked. That old saying.
Yes. So Bob looks over and he sees the red ball is the outsider and it's rolling over to him. And it doesn't have any arms or legs or any kind of features. It seems kind of Shoggothy.
But then it's got these ridges in it where little tentacles with two-toed claws can reach out and do stuff, which I thought was pretty neat and creepy.
So it rolls faster at him, definitely aggressive. Bob feels this wave of nauseating hatred. So it has some kind of psychic projection. That's the way it communicates. So he finds a jagged blue rock. He picks it up to defend himself as the thing is coming at him. The faster it goes, the more spherical this creature gets, and then it slams into the invisible wall. And Bob thinks, this is what the Eternal was talking about, physical strength not being a part of this competition.
A force field, bane of my existence playing with toys as a kid.
Bob and the outsider give this force field a feel up, and it extends all the way across, and it's higher than Bob can reach. The outsider stops about 6 feet away from Bob and seems to be studying him. But of course, Bob can't be sure because it has no obvious sense organs.
Yeah. Is that Bob looking at me? I can't tell.
Bob tries to talk with it, even though he knows the thing probably won't understand him. He asks for peace. Why can't our races make peace so that we can both live?
I thought that was an awesome first move.
Yeah.
Trying for peace. He drops his rock and holds up his hands. Why let this giant Star Trek entity make us fight? We could be brothers. You stay on your side of the street and we stay on our side.
Yeah. So he gets a psychic response that he feels so strongly that it makes him physically fall back a bit.
He recoiled several steps in sheer horror at the intensity of the lust to kill of the red images projected at him. For a moment that seemed eternity, he had to struggle against the impact of that hatred, fighting to clear his mind of it and drive out the alien thoughts to which he had given admittance. He wanted to retch.
So Bob throws up his hands and he accepts it's on like Donkey Kong. The roller, as Bob refers to it, moves to a bush and begins investigating it. It breaks off twigs and Bob can see how strong it is. So he goes over to a bush and tries it. It seems that he's stronger than the roller because it's more effort to break off these twigs for the thing than it is for him. But then he goes, wait a minute, maybe the roller's doing a fake out on me. It was acting like it was harder to break those sticks.
A little lizard, it runs out from the bush and the roller snatches it and pulls its legs off. It's very cold and cruel. Bob forces himself to watch, even though he's freaked out by this brutality. And with half of its legs gone, the lizard just dies. And so the thing tosses the lizard toward Bob, and it flies right through the force field.
The barrier is down. So Bob grabs a sharp rock and he runs for it, and then bam, smack into the barrier. So he tries to compose himself, and then a rock whizzes through and it hits Bob in the leg. The roller picks up another rock and throws it, but this time Bob is ready and he's able to dodge it. The roller isn't very good at throwing rocks, and Bob can easily dodge them when he can see him coming.
Bob throws this sharp rock and it hits the roller, bam, dead center, but doesn't do anything other than, you know, kind of, he shakes the roller, does whatever a roller does to shake it off. It doesn't hurt it mortally.
No, but Bob's leg is hurt by the throw and he's bleeding. He's not too bothered about it because he wants to understand the rules of this barrier.
He kind of downplays the rock thing, but that injury does evolve into something pretty severe.
Yeah.
So it seemed like the roller was kind of a weak, you know, had a little weak flipper arms, but not all that weak. No. If he was able to throw a rock and draw blood. Mm-hmm. Carson's thinking about this barrier.
Yeah. Does it stop organic matter? No, because the dead lizard went through. He grabs a living lizard from the bush and he throws it at the barrier and it just bounces off and runs away. No living matter can cross it. That's the conclusion he's coming to. So the outer barrier is opaque And it's different than the invisible barrier between them. So in this semicircle, semisphere that they're in, they can't see outside of it, but they can see each other. The force field between them is totally invisible.
Yep.
Now the wound on his leg is really beginning to hurt and he's feeling thirsty, but quickly sees there is no water around. With this intense heat in this place, Bob realizes that this fight can't stretch out.
Yeah, that's the ticking clock. He says it's something like 130 degrees Fahrenheit, ooh, something crazy like that. I mean, really Vegas-like temperatures. He has an interesting thought where he says, well, it's supposed to be equally uncomfortable for both of us. This could be even cold to the roller because maybe he lives in a 300-degree world.
Yeah.
And he's freezing, which I thought was interesting.
He looks for rocks that would be good for throwing and bigger rocks with sharp edges so he can use those for hand weapons. He finds some blue flint and he starts to be able to whittle out a knife.
He checks on the roller, which, you know, is keeping out of rock throwing range. And it's also doing something over there, but Bob can't figure out what it is doing.
As he collects rocks, Bob is feeling more fatigued and wore out. And as he recovers, a little lizard comes out and looks at him, and it kind of makes Bob smile. He's like, hey, hello there. And the lizard replies, hello. And this freaks him out for a second, but then it just makes him laugh. He calls the lizard over, but it just runs off. Bob has a new tactic, digging under. So he's going to dig for a while, but it's hard going until he gets about 4 foot deep, and then he hits bedrock. And at the bedrock, still a force field.
He can't tunnel underneath this thing. That was a sort of Alice in Wonderland-like moment with the lizard talking to him. I'm striving to make connections in any way I can. Now, he checks on the roller. He sees that it's building some kind of contraption way off in the distance there. A contraption sort of like a catapult. Mm. Uh-oh. So it gets this thing going, and it launches a rock, but it goes way over Bob's head. So this thing's got some force and will be dangerous. The roller starts making some adjustments to it with his little weird arms and tentacle hand things, and then it tries the contraption again, gets closer this time.
Yeah, so Bob tries to throw some rocks at the roller, but it's too far back. It fires some more rocks at Bob, and it's getting closer, so he retreats to the back of the sphere so that he can see them coming and he has more time to react. One of the rocks hits his rock pile and then it sparks, and this gives Bob an idea. So he tries to burn one of the dry bushes and it goes up in an instant. It goes up so fast it singes his hair. Mm. So he's like, whoa, okay, so this stuff is really flammable. Bob makes some flaming bundles and begins throwing them at the roller and its contraption. The roller drags its catapult further back, but Bob manages to get one on it, and the catapult just bursts into flames and burns up really fast. Bob gets the psychic message from the thing, waves of hate, but not as strong.
So what's he going to do next? I mean, this thing's building stuff. Maybe he should build stuff. He thinks about a bow and arrow, but goes, nah, you know, even with a technologically advanced bow, I'm terrible at that. I could make a spear, but at this long range, the thing would just roll away from it, probably. Mm. If it gets close, the spear would be helpful. So he says, okay, I'm going to go ahead and make one. And then he sort of makes it like a harpoon with a line on it so he can pull it back if he misses when he throws it. And then he ties one end of that line to his wrist.
After he finishes, he realizes he can't stand up. He's too weak. So he crawls as far back as he can to rest, but he falls asleep and he's awakened by a thud. The roller is throwing rocks, and once it sees that Bob is awake, it rolls away from the force field. And Bob's thankful that it doesn't know how weak he is, because it could have kept throwing rocks at him and probably killed him.
He decides he's going to crawl closer to the barrier and try and spear the roller if it comes in closer again. But it's too busy building a second catapult. Mm-hmm. It's going to use the same strategy again. Although the ball is also rolling a little slower than it was before. Mm-hmm. So both of them are obviously being affected by this ticking clock.
Bob fades out for a bit and he realizes that he's slamming his fist against the barrier in futile rage. And he stops and he relaxes. And then he hears the little lizard's voice again, and it says, hurt, kill, come. And it repeats itself over and over, hurt, kill, come. So he realizes the lizard wants him to follow it, and he does.
Now he sees the other lizard that the roller threw away after it savagely had ripped the legs off of it is actually still alive.
Uh-huh.
The one that had passed through the force field, and it's, you know, suffering. So that's what the lizard's trying to get him to do, is help out and do a mercy killing here.
Yeah.
Bob understands. He kills that crippled one. But that means he was wrong about it being an organic-inorganic split. It has more to do with consciousness.
Mm-hmm.
Living things can go through the barrier. They just have to be knocked out or incapacitated in some way.
Mm-hmm.
So if he could stun himself just a bit, if he could knock himself out for a short amount of time, he could get through the barrier and stab this ball with his homemade spear.
This is the point of the story that I was I was done. I was like, what? That's ridiculous. How could one hit oneself and determine, like, I just want to stun myself a bit. Like, for a few seconds, I want to be unconscious. Not because if I'm out for any longer, the roller's going to come over and kill me. How could one know how hard they would have to hit themselves to knock themselves out and then not actually seriously injure yourself either? Because when you are knocked unconscious, that's brain damage that's happening to you. Like, it's just preposterous. Look, this plan is ridiculous.
It's TV logic. You know, the whole, if you get hit once, you're amnesiac, and the way to cure it is hit yourself again. It's that kind of logic. You know, people are getting knocked out left and right in TV and movies. And it's totally nonsense. Yeah. It's also very slapsticky because he's going to have to get on top of a hill when he does this.
Yes.
In order to knock himself out so that he'll fall through the force field. You're going to have to pass through while you're unconscious. So that mechanism's there. It's very funny.
Yes.
But why wouldn't you choke yourself out? I would see maybe that would be a better thing to do. It'd be get a tourniquet and then constrict so that you pass out. Then you would likely maybe just pass out for a second or two.
Oh, yeah, that's a better idea. Because what he could do is, if he had like the rope, because they've got rope that they make from these vines and things.
Yeah.
Is he could be standing and then pull the rope really tight just around his throat. So that if he releases it, so he could just keep pulling it and then be up on his knees. And then when he falls, he would release the rope and then the rope would fall off of his neck and they would go down.
Exactly.
That's a great idea.
See, that I figured that out. I didn't even write that in our notes. I just came up with that right now, which is how I know that this author's long bus trips are bullshit. He's having an affair in another town because he could have solved one bus trip. You would have came up with the same idea. Come on, Frederick.
So Bob's idea is to get on top of this pile of dirt that he dug up when he was digging down to see if he can get under the force field. He gets on top to knock himself out so that he'll roll down the hill and through the barrier on the other side. And he thinks that the roller would assume he's dead since he came through the barrier. Then he will somehow magically come to. Then bam, he's got the roller. So he hits himself over the head with a rock and out he goes.
How did he know? I mean, he had to do some calculation. Now, if I got to hit it hard enough to knock myself out, but I just want like a 30-second knockout. It's so funny. So he comes to. It works.
Yeah.
Carson's got the calculations right. He comes to as the roller's getting over to throw a rock at him and see if he's dead. He tries to keep his mind blank because he knows that this ball has telepathic powers. He's able to do that. He breathes as shallowly as he can, so the thing gets really close.
And Bob is able to get an impression of the thing's mind as it scans him. He said it's like a spider's. It thinks and it is complex, but it just wants to kill. And there would never be any peaceful coexistence with these creatures. Bob understands that on a deep level.
Yeah. As it moves closer, bam, he whips the harpoon out with all his strength. It pierces the roller's flesh deeply. And the thing goes, actually, I don't know if it does that. That's just what I imagine. It rolls away. Bob tries to follow, but he's too weak. The roller reaches the end of the harpoon rope and stops.
It reached the end of the rope, and he was jerked forward by the pull on his wrist. It dragged him a few feet and then stopped. Carson kept going, pulling himself towards it hand over hand along the rope. It stopped there, tentacles trying in vain to pull out the harpoon. It seemed to shudder and quiver, and then realized that it couldn't get away, for it rolled back towards him, clawed tentacles reaching out. Stone knife in hand, he met it. He stabbed, again and again, while those horrid claws ripped skin and flesh and muscle from his body. He stabbed and slashed, and at last, it was still.
You know, I never knew where the phrase at the end of your rope came from. It's from the story.
It's the story.
Yeah.
We learned so much doing this show.
Wow.
Now, just then, Bob is back in his starfighter, and he gets a call over the comms. It's his CEO, and he says, the whole battle's over. All the outsiders are dead.
Bob looks down at his leg, and he can see there's a healed scar from where that rock hit him from the attack on the blue sand. He also has some other scars from the battle that tells him, oh my gosh, it was all real. Yeah. I thought it would have been better if he'd reached in his pocket and a bunch of blue sand came out, you know? But that was cool. It all really happened.
So Bob asks to his CEO, how did the outsiders die?
Don't know exactly. We fired one salvo and their whole fleet went up in dust. Whatever it was jumped from ship to ship in a flash. Even the ones we hadn't aimed at and that were out of range. The whole fleet disintegrated before our eyes and we didn't get the paint of a single ship scratched. We can't even claim credit for it. must have been some unstable component in the metal they used, and our sighting shot just set it off. Man, too bad you missed all the excitement. Carson managed a sickly ghost of a grin, for it would be days before he'd be over the impact of his experience. But the captain wasn't watching. Yes, sir, he said. Common sense, more than modesty, told him he'd be branded as the worst liar in space if he ever said any more than that. Yes, sir. Too bad I missed all the excitement.
And that's the end of the story.
A little bit of a wink there at the end.
Oh, I'd be so frustrated if I had saved the entire universe and the entire human race and wasn't able to tell anybody.
Yeah, yeah. You could tell them, just nobody would believe you.
Also, I'm the worst liar in space. Or am I? I'm Vincent Price.
Oh, yeah. We haven't had lying Vincent Price on the podcast, on the new podcast. So welcome, lying Vincent Price.
I've been on every episode.
No, that's not true. You're lying.
Well, that was a cool story. It was lots of action and a lot of fun and inadvertently a good slapstick time. Although I guess that this author is somewhat of a comic author. As you said, the big novel was a parody of sci-fi things.
Yeah, yeah. I do think that the Star Trek episode is a bit of an improvement on this story as well. I like the idea because they're made to fight by the Metrons. That's the alien race. Mm-hmm. And Kirk, at the last minute, doesn't kill the Gorn that he's fighting because he's like, look, you know, I'm not going to just murder a guy. I don't care what you want me to do. I'm just not going to do it. And then, of course, the Metron is like, ah, you are more evolved than this other creature. You have a potential. We like you better and we will give you our favor, but we won't kill all of the other ones. We'll just send them on their way.
Yeah.
Obviously, this story was a bit different because these creatures are so aggressive and they weren't going to give up. And he understood that with his psychic communication. It just felt like there was a little bit more depth. And the idea that the ingenuity of knowing the elements that make gunpowder and then making a gun, I thought that was much cooler than knocking himself out with a rock.
Yeah, that was a much cooler, I think even as a kid, that one would have been, I didn't notice the bad fighting, but if that had happened in the episode, I would have gone, what? What? Gornography was a much better episode than the story. I think so too. Well, I want to thank our reader.
Yeah, Rafe Ball is rocking and rolling as he always does, as this story had rocks and rolling in it.
You know, if you enjoyed our discussion of Star Trek on this episode, and also if you enjoyed Rafe's performance, you can get more of both over on Chris's other podcast, Rachel Watches Star Trek.
That's true. Rafe is often a guest on our show. He is very knowledgeable in Star Trek and he runs our quizzes that we do on our season wrap-ups. He's just a great guy. I love him to death.
Next week, we're going to do another Alice in Wonderland themed story. This one's more of a horror story. Mm-hmm. Also a little bit of a, I'd say literary short story. Yeah. It seemed to me to resemble a Raymond Carver story a little bit, but we'll talk about that more next week. That story is called The Sea Was Wet As Wet Can Be, and making his first appearance on the show is author Gayan Wilson. That's the author of that story, so please stay tuned for that. It's going to be a good one. You know, I want to thank some patrons as well.
Yeah. I'd like to thank David Luce.
I'd like to thank Charles Mickle.
Jiggins, thank you.
Clara, thank you.
Jason of the K, thank you.
Matthew Courtwright, thank you so much.
Thank you, Ryan Harrison.
Marco Van Putten, thank you.
Luke Frizon, thank you.
And finally, Reese Atkins, thanks for being a patron. You guys are all great. Keep the show running. Hope you're enjoying Strange Studies of Strange Stories. We're going to be back with more of those next week. For now, I'm Chad Pfeiffer.
I'm Chris Lackey, and you've been listening to Strange Studies of Strange Stories.
Exclusively on Patreon.
Strange Studies of Strange Stories.